So first, let me ask you just about anything that came up. I had suggested a practice for lying in bed last night. And then one of the things that I'm sure we'll talk about from time to time as the week goes on is once you're kind of looking at things from a TSK perspective, Kumye becomes a great place to do TSK practice. Mm-hmm. So maybe something came up for those of you who went to the tea to the who did morning Kumye. So anything anybody would like to share there?
Oh, I was floating.
Okay.
I was trying to work more with, as I was trying to fall asleep last night, I was trying to work more with thoughts and feelings and sensations, because I think when we were sitting here last night, I was trying to, more sensations came up, so that's what I was expanding.
Mm-hmm.
But then as I was lying down, I kept thinking about, I was trying to figure out how do you expand a thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of played with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So how do you expand a thought?
Well, in my head, first I tried making it a yell.
A yell, okay. So, yeah, so the thought is in words.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then I made it louder in my head, or more insistent, or it just sort of seemed to take up more space. And then I tried to see if, that still sounds weird, I tried to see if I could make it go outside of my head as a way of expanding it.
Mm-hmm. So those are both really interesting and you know, I say legitimate, but in fact, everything goes in TSK, you could say. But those are both really interesting things to do. But there's a couple of presuppositions in that. One is, first of all, thought is in words.
Mm.
Right? So is that your, would you say thoughts are always in words?
Not always. But the ones I was working with definitely
were.
Yeah.
So there's somebody's voice.
Yeah.
In your head.
Yeah.
Is it your voice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And although sometimes I see them.
Mm-hmm.
See the words.
And you see the words.
Sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Okay. So that's one assumption. I want to ask people about that too. That's interesting. But the second assumption was, oh yeah, you try to expand them outside your head. So that suggests that the thoughts are going on inside your head.
Yeah, I thought about that because I felt like I needed to find a location for them before I could expand them.
Before you could expand them.
Yeah.
Right. That's a legitimate approach. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily have to be the case that something has to be located somewhere before you expand it, and that's a pretty spatial sense of expansion, but maybe there are other ways of expanding something,
right?
You know, I'm not saying that, I mean, that's a fine way to do it. I'm just saying that there's a lot of possibilities to explore, and one of the kind of fundamental things about TSK, it seems to me, is that you don't want to close off possibilities. You know, you don't want to let your presuppositions close things down. So, for instance, the presupposition, perhaps in this case, that thoughts are always in words.
Mm.
How do people feel about that? Does anybody disagree with that notion that thoughts are always in words?
When you said that, it was interesting to me, because I probably tend to myself
mm-hmm.
define a thought as something that's in language
mm-hmm.
some way, and other, not that there aren't other mental thing, images, and so I don't know what technically is a thought or not, because I would tend to think of a thought as something that has some language that I'm doing. I don't think of it as having a voice in my side of my head, but it's sort of the spirit. Is it voice, or is it seeing words, or but in some way language seems language related to me, as opposed to an image or association or
mm-hmm.
something like that. So that would be my reaction to you.
It's a okay.
Well, I'll wait.
Well, I was going to say that a friend of mine, I'm not going to go do my little rap about him, but I have a friend who thinks about these things a lot, and he says his conclusion is that the word thought is one of the most poorly understood and defined words in the English language. And his explanation for why that's the case is interesting. He says, well, there's no referent. I guess that's the short version. You know, when you're growing up and you're learning language and somebody says, I think, you know, or I was thinking about this, then you just connect that up with whatever you do when you think about this, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, that's what thinking is. But there's no way to test. You know, I mean, if we had classes when you were 6 years old saying, no, let's really examine the notion of a thought, then maybe people would come to some kind of consensus or open up. I don't necessarily want a consensus, but open up to other possibilities. You know? But as it is, nobody ever talks about that. So you just wind up thinking, well, whatever it is that I do when I think about something, that's what thinking is. But it may be very, very different for different people. So, you know, you're just giving the example. If you don't really hear the voice, but it's in words somehow, right? Okay. Well.
This isn't exactly following, but I had an experience that was not verbal at all, and I do have a lot of voices in my head, so that goes on a lot for me. But this was not verbal, and I tried to put it in words,
mm-hmm.
Which became complicated. It was a very visceral experience, and also there was memory involved. I mean, I think the memory opened up the visceral experience, and then the visceral experience, I mean, this is a linear description, was vast.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, I can't be stunned about I was carrying this, and mm-hmm. There was some judgment, I didn't pay attention to it, or I didn't remember this, or I remember another experience related to this of always trying to put into words experiences that were wordless,
mm-hmm.
for me, and that were very strong,
mm-hmm.
and feeling forced to do that,
yeah.
by circumstance. So this actually happened this morning when I woke.
So I want to ask you a question about that, but I'm
wondering
first.
Now it's annoying, right? Yeah. Yeah. Should we just nicely tell them we're having?
Yeah. We can if we can get to them. Oh, here they are. Yeah. Say, Doug.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jack.
That's okay. Okay. So, what was the need to put it into words?
There were two needs. I can't differentiate anymore the one that came from me. But there was, as if there was no room for living with that by myself. I mean, well, that was two things. From me, it was wanting to connect it. It seemed.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is full of memories right this second, so it's very hard to navigate. But then getting some social things, getting ignored if I didn't, quote, explain or say
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you doing? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Or, are you dreaming? You know, smile or do this or behave. You know, so some demand on the outside. But I think there was also, and I can't tell, you know, something from inside that it may
mm-hmm.
have been learned
mm-hmm.
to make that connection or verbalize it. But this morning, I did think of verbalizing it to myself,
mm-hmm.
and it was a trial.
Mm.
It was a trial. And I thought, well, someday I'll get to the point where I won't do this anymore, meaning won't verbalize it.
Won't verbalize it. Well, So the relationship between the experience and then the putting it into words afterwards, that's a very interesting thing. I don't think we need to look at it more right now, but I'm glad you bring it up. Add it to the mix of things that, that we're kind of bearing in mind, yeah. You see?
The more I've looked at thoughts, they seem to, everything's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it seems, or that the, that they, so I tend to note whole sentences or whole descriptions, but that's mostly what's not, it is not what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a kind of collage of images and words and sound, you know, memories, noticings, and it just goes on until you, well, until you close your eyes, and then it goes on in
mm-hmm.
another way. It doesn't seem that different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I used to feel that conscious life was more different from dreams than now it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that the collage quality and the
mm-hmm.
cutoffs and the movements, it's just easier to edit them out in the day.
Mm-hmm.
That's was the feeling. I kept thinking or kept something. As the day would go on, I would be further and further away from this experience
mm-hmm.
unless I activated it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I activated it, it would be antisocial because I would be very engaged in something other.
Mm-hmm.
And you said yesterday, last night, you don't have to meditate all day. Did you say that, or did I dream that? I see, I told you. But it's going on all the time. You don't have to do that all the time. But, and there are natural moments, like when you're swimming, you bring your head up for air, it's quote natural. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you need air, but that living experience for me, if I really descend into it, is a nonstop thing. So having to come up for air and making a contact
uh-huh.
or cut off. And so as the day would progress, as the sun, you know, more and more the demand
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to keep going, and so I felt some anxiety actually about losing it.
Losing that, what you described as the visceral experience.
The visceral and its components or
mm-hmm.
acts.
Mm-hmm.
And that in terms of social life, that demand of social life or activities would take me further and further from that, which seemed so fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, those are the kinds of issues, among many others, that we'll be looking at or potentially looking at. I want to, as I said, I want to do a lot of practice. So I do want to go through something from the book, but first I'd like us to practice. And I actually thought I would, we'd go back and do a practice very similar to what we did at the beginning last night. But this is just a kind of different formulation that comes from love of knowledge. We're going to follow the suggestion in the exercise, which is that you write down afterwards, you come up for air, as it were, maybe, and write down something of your experience. But first, you have to have the practice. So I'm just going to read you the instruction, which is quite simple. Note the kinds of mental events. This is exercise two, but I don't think you need to look it up. Note the kinds of mental events that come up in the mind and their relationship. Images and feelings, intentions, thoughts, judgments, etc. And then it asks a couple of questions. Which elements are dominant and which supportive? It's only one possible question. There's so many, you know, many different questions may kind of naturally present themselves. But which elements are dominant and which supportive? How do states such as tension, conflict, boredom, calm, clarity, appreciation. And again, that's just the beginning of a list that could stretch out a long way. Right? How how to state such as tension, conflict, boredom, calm, clarity, or appreciation arise. So it's asking you to look at the arising states. So the images that come up, the events that come up, their relationship in terms of factors such as dominant and supportive, and their arising. And again, if you want to ask other questions, that's fine. The exercise is called Layers of Maya. And then he says, keep a journal in which you record your discoveries, an annotated catalog of the contents of your mind.
So I'm not assuming I understand. What does it mean, supportive?
Right, dominant and supportive. Well, for instance, if you remember something and there's an emotion associated with that, maybe it's a painful memory. So is the memory the dominant part and the emotion kind of supportive or comes up in its wake? Or is the emotion the dominant part and the memory is kind of supportive? That would be an example. Okay? So, mental events, their relationship, their arising. Actually, you might then say they're passing away. So we'll do this for about 20 minutes and then take a little time to write as well. The journal of your discoveries, as it says. So have something ready to write on in a minute. You don't need to feel confined to sitting in the chair. I mean, if you want to move around, if you want to take a different position, if you want to sit on a cushion, that's fine. If you want to go outside, you know, try to be back within about 20 minutes. But if you want to walk somewhere, I mean, the mind is active, you know, so you don't have to put yourself in a particular situation where you say, well, this is not, here's where I get to activate my mind. No, the mind is always busy. So the practice can be done in any circumstance. Okay, about 20 minutes. Okay. So take a few minutes to make some notes to yourself about that. Thank you.
might be that one. Okay.
So I noticed people had a fair amount to write down. But what did you notice that you might like to share?
I found that the first thing that was really predominant when I went into that, there was a kind of a, it almost felt like a wavelength. There was a kind of frequency that I could feel it as a kind of overall tone to the activity of the mind, where there's a frequency to it. I could feel that, so I felt it kind of having a directionality and a feeling quality, and then the thoughts and images arose in relation to that frequency.
So the frequency was kind of like a rhythm. Is that fair to say? Or?
It seemed to be not quite a very slow wavelength, in a sense that there was a kind of like a stream that has a kind of, it's hard to describe, but there's a feeling quality to it that has a it was smooth, it was directed in terms of flowing in a particular way. It had that quality that I could tell that if I followed it, it seemed to support the kind of content that was arising. And as I went further, at first the kind of contents that were arising were a little bit disjointed, thoughts and images, some judgments, little flickering things, you know, just a whole constellation of types of events were related to that. But somehow that frequency seemed to change, and the contents changed into a very vivid, it's like everything coalesced into more like a waking visualization or dream, where there was actually suddenly just popped in a whole fully formed scene of a beagle puppy wandering in a field and coming to stand in a little depression surrounded by grass, and he was looking around through the grass. It was just like all there, and I noticed that the feeling tone shifted around that. So, but then I noticed that if I chose to focus on an element of the dream and became deliberative and active, then the feeling tone, this kind of state that supported, could shift. So there seemed to be a kind of two-way. There was a state that kind of supported, but then as I engaged, it could shift the state that was there. I think the last thing I was noticing was, let's see. Well, yeah, it's interesting. It was kind of a consciousness of moving into unconsciousness, which is, I felt there was, the activity had set up a kind of observing ego or something, where I was looking around and checking everything out. And I noticed towards the end, I started getting into a sleepier state, and it felt like there was the loss of a kind of observing center. And so moving into that more diffuse state felt like, there was a loss of that kind of center, but there was also simultaneously a kind of identification with the contents, so that quality of sleepiness and less consciousness involved more of a kind of fusion with the content, if that makes sense.
Okay, good. Well, there's a lot going on there. Let me say, by the way, in a kind of a discussion that would follow an exercise like this, that's a great place to keep doing the exercise, right? Because you have all sorts of, not necessarily reactions, but you know, while at least I was very noticeable, aware of this, that while Bruce was speaking, there were, you know, there was a lot going on in me. There was taking in what he said, and part of it was reactions, but part of it there were just various things going on. So the practice can continue, and that's kind of a slogan in TSK. I just made it up. I've never seen it before. But it would work as a slogan. You'd say, you know, the practice continues. TSK, colon, the practice continues. You know, sort of like the truth is out there. Your own experience and other people's experience, both, it seems to me, are just inherently really interesting, because people are really different, you know, and it's the range of possibilities is endless, and I think you learn something from other people's experience and helps you reflect back on your own. So. Okay, anybody else?
I just had a similar, I mean, we spoke about it so differently that it may not be connected, but I was just struck when you started talking, that you started with wavelength. I started with the thoughts, and then down through the contents of the thoughts to just that they were thoughts and this sort of thing. But then coming down to looking at sensations from doing so much kumye and asking what's supportive and what's dominant there. The thought seems dominant at first, but you look at when I look at the sensations, sometimes I think that they map the thought, and then I was getting and that they may be the dominant, or maybe it shifts, and then there's a it doesn't sound like it should be deeper, but it feels deeper sense of image, shadowy image forms that I would say that sounded similar to me to your wavelength, that seem even beneath that all and maybe more dominant, and just they just have a powerful, even though they're shadowy, or they just have a powerful, I just want to do with them what you did with the wavelength, where they seem to be driving the thing. And I don't know if you thought that the little beagle was sort of riding on that wave, or was sort of
what was on that channel.
Yeah.
Very imaginative channel.
It was one of many images who could have popped up to explain. I mean, it just seems like the mind is so busy making stories or pictures or whatever, but you get down lower and there's this, and I don't know if lower is the right word, it seems non-locatable in a way, but yeah, I couldn't tell what was dominant and what was supportive, really. It's almost a shifting sense. But I was just struck with that, similar, whether or not it is similar, feels similar to me, that that there's the wavelength, or it's odd that you should have it's probably not odd, but that there could be all these other channels that seem to be carrying the same information, that just picture or sense or sensation or rhythm
mm-hmm.
is similar. And so when you look at those, you think the thoughts are just.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Is that too?
Yeah.
I had a similar sort of trouble with the supportive dominance. I went into the exercise really fascinated by the comment that you made earlier about, you know, the lack of clear definition of thinking. So I really got busy with that. and in a sense it was really clearly dominant. and I was thinking, you know, what's the difference between daydreaming and thinking and imagining and thinking? And then I started looking at that, and I noticed that I had this great curiosity, and it seemed to be feeding the thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that was the supportive part. But, you know, in one sense it kept the thinking going.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and so at first I thought, well, that's the supportive part.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of transfer to the curiosity, focusing on the curiosity, when you think, well, maybe it's just that curiosity was the dominant part
right.
and caused the thinking.
Right.
And I kind of got stuck there, and it just seemed like this symbiotic relationship that just kept this thing moving forward.
Are you saying that the curiosity is different from thinking?
It seemed to be an emotional, more of an emotional kind of feeling that drove the thought process. It seemed to me that it was, that there was this general interest that I could have in a lot of different situations that was applied to this specific thought that had come up. So yeah, they're very much related, but I just could feel that they were different things.
Well, when you say the word curiosity, it seems to me to be a more mental thing, so I would be, quote, curious to know if it, you know, what kind of a sensation.
To me, the curious, it was definitely a sensation. It was a you know, I've run into lots of different times, of wanting to know. It's a feeling of wanting to discover.
It's a pull.
Yeah, it's a pulling, yeah, desire, and almost like a desire, but not quite that strong. You know, with a different sort of feeling to it.
Is it so when you say, you know, you didn't have any trouble with the word sensation, but to me, sensation suggests something in the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a location in the body for that pulling?
That's a good question. I don't know. But yeah, no, it was more of a physical kind of, as I was looking at it, it was definitely a physical kind of.
Well, you keep going here.
Yeah, I know, and that's what I'm thinking too. It was kind of here.
Uh-huh. Well, that's why, for me, it was hard when you said it's wanting to know did not feel like a sensation to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's more inchoate than that, you know, it's more, I don't know what the word to use, but it's not shaped, it's not a form.
No.
Yeah, so that wanting to know feels already formed, like, okay, here's an idea, this is what I am, you know, I want to know, I want to.
So it sounds like it's a lot more verbal for you.
Yeah, but that's putting words on, you know, you're trying to describe this feeling, and it's putting words on it. And
right.
So that actually sounds like the distinction you were making earlier about visceral and putting words on it.
Right, well, that's what I thought he was doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what it seemed to me. It was, and when Cecilia was also saying this whole idea of which comes first, it seems clear in my experience which came first, but there's a quick rush to explain it, or to label it, or to define it, or give it form. It's before form, it
mm-hmm.
feels like.
Well, so are you saying that for you...
Yeah.
There could or could not be a visceral wanting to know.
Well, I don't know what it is. I mean, I wouldn't use that word, wanting to know.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like wanting to grab, or it feels, you know, wanting to take, wanting to, you know,
mm-hmm.
put in your mouth, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, I wouldn't call that wanting to know. I mean, it's like I could eat the book, but it's below that. It's below that, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And I similarly had what you all were saying about what you call frequency. For me, it was a quivering, a trembling in my body, in this part of my body. And then thought was generated, as I described it to myself, to relieve it,
mm-hmm.
to exorcise it, or to, what I said before, like to explain it. To tell myself.
Okay, so the thought is kind of like a safety valve.
Yes.
Interesting. So the verbalization specifically?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like what Robert said too, is just, but I know, it is to make sense of it. There was a whole process involved in trying to use it in some way, and to relieve it, the original feeling, just to be with that was... wasn't hard, it was very familiar, but there was a split.
Okay. So, just to make an observation, there's a kind of a balance between communicating with each other and staying within our own experience, you know? And I think sometimes what one person says kind of triggers something in another person, and there's a level of communication, but there's also a possibility that you're not really talking about the same thing mm-hmm. at all.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's what you were saying. You were saying before about the curiosity.
Yeah, and I just think it's important to be aware that you know you sort of want to let one person's experience be that person's experience, mm-hmm. and if somebody's commenting on your experience, it's kind of you know it can be interesting and helpful, and questions I think can help illuminate. Because in fact, our experience is usually richer than our, well, it's always richer than our description of it.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it can get caught into what is at some level versus, well, this is my experience, is there something, mm-hmm. you know, and as if, you know, I mean, Robert had his experience, you get a reaction, but then it starts to talk about as if there's some
something.
Objective thing
mm-hmm.
that we're trying to
yeah.
get
yeah.
to, right, as opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Your own experience. That's another thought I had going back related to this. I was thinking something similar as Bruce, you were talking, and then Jack, you commented on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just noticing the difference between being in my own experience during the exercise, and then as Bruce started to talk, it was such a different thing to be listening to him
mm-hmm.
and what you said about going. You know, it was that experience that I had, and I was listening to him. My experience and reaction to that. So, so it goes back to what you're saying. There was strong. I'm sort of continuing that awareness as we're talking that difference. And one other thing that to me is striking, I thought that occasionally this has hit me at times before, of how, you know, what speaking and hearing is. I mean, just paying attention to you speaking, and that's, you know, how when we speak, we're making these noises that then.
Right.
Cause wave patterns, then we hear and then we do something with it. But that's such an amazing process that, you know, we're making a word or these whole sentences that we just sort of rattle off as if, oh, no big deal. But it's this whole thing that's happening, you know, they're just, you know, airwaves
right.
going across that hit your ear and then go into our
mm-hmm.
brains and
mm-hmm.
become thoughts. And then I'll just sort of off on that a little bit. But that's just incredibly fascinating that we just take for granted that that's. We're doing.
No, I've had that a similar thought anyway many times that you know it's a little it's almost the same as what you said. It's a part of it that amazes me is that we can just say things. It's incredible. You know, we don't plan out what we're going to say, like when I'm speaking right now, I don't you know, there's some maybe supportive sense of where I want to be going, but in fact the words just come out. And how does that happen? It really is amazing. Is. So yeah, I'm just agreeing with you. And it's one of the many kind of miracles, you could say, that our ordinary version of how things are just doesn't touch.
Yeah.
You know, we whatever explanation you ask someone on the street, I mean, you know, maybe they say, well, I don't know. But if they come up with something, it just doesn't seem like our usual explanations can get anywhere near the power of how something like that is possible, or also the power of you know the kind of richness of our experience. I mean, what people have been describing is really really rich, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what goes on all the time. We just don't even notice it.
Well, I'll throw in one other comment for me. The dominant thing going back to giving me exercise that I was struck by. Some sort of meditation is how much is going on,
mm-hmm,
how
mm-hmm.
much I'm not, you know, say, not putting, you know, not aware of for one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. stop paying attention, you know, pay attention to it. It's like, oh wow, just look at all that stuff. And when we started off talking about how there was a certain stream, it's like, oh geez, mine felt more like sort of popcorn feeling, just sort of going off. But then you started to say that, how that was happening too, although you also had that frequency, but that was more of the experience, and that started to calm down a little bit with
mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
exercise, but then also I was aware of how much, you know, paying attention is not, I'm not either being aware of it or communicating in some way, this sort of speech thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I let's keep going with this a little while and then take a break. I was going to do another practice, but I think it's better to keep going now. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. Pamela, I wanted to ask you, because you had raised a question and I wound up kind of engaged with it, or you brought up the theme of thoughts in words.
Mm.
Were you looking at that in this practice, or did that, was that interesting?
That might have been the dominant part of my practice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In fact, and I my experience was different from what's been described, and
mm-hmm.
perhaps it's the way I understood the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, but I actually think I spent most of my time looking for words, in fact, to apply to experiences or to thoughts. Because so I understood there was a lot of labeling that
mm-hmm.
went on in my experience. So it was like something, a thought arose, and then I was like, oh, the exercise is to give that thought a label, so that or categorize that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the thought almost always arose as words, although I connected to what Lois said about having experience before words, and in fact, as I was going out, I was thinking a lot about that, about even remembering the transition in myself from having experiences and then having to always explain experiences, so then
mm-hmm.
that always meant finding words for things, so
mm-hmm.
words became very dominant.
Mm-hmm.
So words were very, very dominant, and I couldn't really connect to the supportive thing, but there was this cycle of thought, categorize or label, question that kind of was going around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I was looking at that and trying to sort of see, was there links that were set up? So did a particular kind of thought then give rise to another kind of thought, so that categories were linked or followed one another for
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For some reason or in some regular analyzable fashion. So so when I was writing stuff down, I was mostly kind of writing down the different labels that I applied to the different
mm-hmm.
types of thought that came up.
So where Robert had this maybe dominant wanting to know, you have a dominant wanting to label.
Yeah, yeah. Although there was something about the wanting to know, I mean, that came up, so that was one of my labels. and that was one, and that was actually one of the chains that came up as well. So it was like, I sat outside, so sometimes there was something outside which stimulated, like there were dragonflies flying around, and so then there's this, you know, and they have this, what seems to me a very irregular pattern of doing things, so then I'm like, why does that happen, and what, you know, what's going on for the dragonfly? So then that was a whole thought thing that I started categorizing, so yeah, it was a labeling, categorizing kind of
mm-hmm.
experience.
Mm-hmm. And were there times when that shifted into something else? I mean, that was the dominant thing. The word, actually, you know, I don't usually focus so much on the dominant supportive part,
mm-hmm.
but if they're in the instructions and people clearly, you know, found that interesting, so they went with it. But sometimes, I mean, dominant might just mean dominant in the sense of 80% of the time I was doing this, or,
mm.
you know. So, but I guess if it was dominant in that sense, were there times when there was other kind of stuff going on that had nothing to do with labeling?
Yeah, I think I had to actively bring myself back to the labeling.
Mm,
mostly because I wanted to be able to remember so that I could have
right.
something to write down. In the absence of that, I think I would have followed
mm-hmm.
chains more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, because after the dragonfly, there was the little iguana, and then there was
mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
bird, and so like there was
mm-hmm.
just sort of all of these interesting things happening outside that, and I think it was mostly a curiosity, sort of like, I've looked at that before and never hadn't had a thought about why that happens or what that is.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so it was this exercise kind of gave me space to ask the question about
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
event. So.
Okay. I'll say something about my experience, because that issue of thinking in words is something I've actually reflected on a lot in the past. And one of the conclusions I've come to for myself, and again, I don't necessarily say this is true for anybody else, people are really different, is that I do have a lot of words running through my mind, through my thoughts, through my mind, let's say. But they are usually in the form of conversations. And the thought is something bigger than the words. The thought is a situational thought. It's like remembering something that happened in the past, or anticipating something that happened in the future, or fantasizing about something else. And very often, those involve interactions with other people. And so the thought involves a conversation, and there's words going on. But I wouldn't say that the thought is the words, you know, the thought is the whole situation. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've looked at before, but it was interesting to see.
I was thinking about that. Then my thought also on, like, as if some sort of structure, like an event happened, and then within that structure of event or memory or planning or world wish or dream or whatever, then there are few, let's say, conversations or ideas just come in. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell, is it a whisper or is it in words? It's just, it makes itself known, but I can't really know how it, what medium does it come through? It's mm-hmm. hard, because I'm not so, if I get that detailed in tune to it, I may even lose it all. Mm-hmm. So kind of if I stay loose to it, I can see the structure and the flow of some sort of making itself known, ideas, thoughts, sometimes images.
Well, thoughts may not have a particular vehicle, like words or images. It's, again, it's, our inner experience is really interesting, and it's also, and this is another one of those quite remarkable things, really unknown. You know, we don't, I mean, you'd think we were very familiar with our own inner processes, because that's what we do 100% of the time, is engage in inner processes. I'll give you one. But we're not. You know, we don't look in that direction.
Well, isn't that culturally bound too? I mean, I don't know enough about other cultures inwardly,
right.
But I mean, my experience is so much demanded that I move the other direction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
So there's a constant translation. Even in school, very early classes, you know, teaching you to come out. To say this right on the board, right on your paper, stand up and give show and tell, do whatever it is that translates it, and you know, after a while, it's a brainwashing exercise.
It's not a brainwashing. I relate. It's almost like externally becoming oriented more,
yes.
Attuned with external cues versus tuning in. And that's exactly what I wrote, that I was noticing how much effort it takes for me to really tune in and go to my true experience and be authentic and really relax into it. How much effort it takes. And if I'm alone at home, very quickly. But if there are social few people, even one person, how more I come out. And I think that's also socially, culturally, and familial. Like my family of origin are very externally oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Some families are more, like, they smile less every minute, or they're just more into themselves. So I think it's culturally and familial structure. But I really noticed that it's how to tune in, but it, what treasure it is, and it only has to happen in these sort of settings or when I'm alone. I can't be, let's say, in my work or at school, let's say, or somebody around. I cannot easily do that. What a shame.
Well, one of the qualities, I think, in TSK inquiry is very nicely expressed by Rinpoche in Knowledge of Freedom when he talks about two-way sensing. That's the phrase he uses. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a way into the possibility that you were just saying isn't so readily available, which is in the middle of whatever experience you're engaged in, there is also the experiencing of it. And that's what he means roughly by two-way sensing, right? Is there's the, you might say, the content of the experience or the ongoing interaction with your environment or with others in your environment. But there's also an awareness and an appreciation possible of what's happening within you. Now, within is a metaphor. We have to look at that, if you will. But, you know, your own, these are all metaphors, your own rich inner experience. That, there's no reason that can't be available. And actually, if we just start to practice that, as I was suggesting before, in our conversations with each other, you know, to be aware of what is being said, and it comes in effortlessly. That's another part of the kind of miraculous quality of speech, right? We don't have to worry about making sense out of it. It just makes sense. So right? So you know, it's so different from you know, when you're trying to find your way in a foreign language where you don't know it very well. You really struggle to make sense. But we have learned in our own language, you know, things just automatically make sense to us. So while that content is coming in, and you know, perhaps while there's some kind of reaction to it, the reaction already starts to take you in this direction of your own experience, and that's. So I think that image, I like that phrase a lot, two-way sensing.
Thank you.
Goes to that. Yeah, I like that. It, remember, a phrase that came to me was the river that flows out curls also in.
Hmm.
And there's a sense of the kind of the current that rolls back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've used that in looking at my own
mm-hmm.
thought while experiencing the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a second? I just want to say one thing about
sure.
the thought, because I'm wanting to offer it for inquiry. Is one experience that I've had in looking at thought, and I'm wondering if it's actually thought showing up this way just because I'm looking this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but for me, I really related to you talking about how the thought contains the words, but it seems to be situational or
mm-hmm.
something. For me, it seems like thought kind of can come up as this a whole bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And I can either engage it and then an entire sentence can unfold out of it,
mm-hmm.
or I don't engage it and then the bubble's gone. And if I don't engage it, there's almost like, you know, when you have that word on the edge of your tongue and you can't, that the meaning that was in that bubbling up can quickly be just evaporate for me if I don't pop it a little bit and pull out that sentence.
Articulate
yeah.
it.
Right. Well, thoughts, yeah, and maybe somebody else has a comment on that. It does seem to me thoughts go by, you know, really quickly. There, that's better. You know, and we miss most of them, probably, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Rinpoche writes, I think it's in Love of Knowledge somewhere, he says, let's just think, he says, how many thoughts do you have in an hour? You know? And people, I think, tend to underestimate, but let's say you imagined you had 100 thoughts in an hour. I think that's way underestimated, but let's say 100 thoughts in an hour. And then he says, and so how many people are there in the world? Well, there's 6 billion. So let's say, I think we're closing in on 7 billion, I read. But, so let's say at any given time, 4 billion of them are awake. So 4 billion times 100 thoughts is 400 billion, right? So he says, okay, so there's 400 billion thoughts in the world in an hour, kind of low estimate. And so how many of them are valuable?
Just a thought on what you're saying.
Right.
It's like, that I had was, so where do you distinguish a thought versus, you know, there's a stream that, you know, at what point do you distinguish a that was that thought, this was another thought, as opposed to, you know, is something happening. Is one thought, maybe one thought. The other thing I was thinking, Bruce, as you were saying, was like, you know, that sense of sort of potential for something to become more that could fade away too. So what's the difference between what sort of automatically is coming up all the time, and then when we give our attention to it or put it into words, it, you know, that's a sort of different, in a sense, a different process or a different variation of the process. You know, there's a certain automatic thing that's happening, and then there's, you know, I decided to say something, so that took that thought I had and turned it into, as you were saying, this sort of flow of words that, you know,
right,
just came out, but it's due to some choice that I made to try to put it into words.
Okay, well, I think I'm going to take this occasion to read you something because it's related to what we're just talking about, especially kind of the opposite of this two-way sensing. It was just something I read a couple of days ago on the web, and I knew it would be relevant at some point. So I'll read it now, and then I don't have to worry about it anymore. And it may be helpful for us as something, you know, as a reference point. So this was in an article, a column, I guess, in the New York Times called "I Tweet, Therefore I Am."
I tweet or I tweet?
That must not be, I don't tweet.
Tweet.
Oh, tweet. Okay.
Yes. So back in the 1950s, the sociologist Irving Goffman famously argued that all of life is performance. We act out a role in every interaction, adapting it based on the nature of the relationship or context at hand. Twitter has extended that metaphor to include aspects of our experience that used to be considered offset. Eating pizza in bed, reading a book in the tub, thinking a thought anywhere, flossing. Effectively, it makes the grease paint permanent, blurring the lines not only between public and private, but also between the authentic and contrived self. If all the world was once a stage, it has now become a reality TV show. We mere players are not just aware of the camera, we mug for it. The expansion of our digital universe, Second Life, Facebook, Twitter, has shifted not only how we spend our time, but also how we construct identity. For her coming book, Alone Together, Sherry Turkle, a professor at MIT, interviewed more than 400 children and parents about their use of social media and cell phones. Among young people especially, she found that the self was increasingly becoming externally manufactured rather than internally developed, a series of profiles to be sculptured and refined in response to public opinion. On Twitter or Facebook, you're trying to express something real about who you are, she explained, but because you're also creating something for others' consumption, you find yourself imagining and playing to your audience more and more. So those moments in which you're supposed to be showing your true self become a performance. Your psychology becomes a performance.
Wow.
Thank you.
So appropriate.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take our break. And let me suggest that during the break, I'm always jealous about time on retreats. I always say, well, during the retreat, just keep on practicing. And keep looking. It's not even right to say keep on practicing, but what we're doing is inviting the possibility of looking into this remarkable range of immediate experience. So just, you know, it doesn't have to get in the way. Just let that be an additional factor that happens during the break. So we'll take a half an hour break. It's 10:36, so 6 minutes after 11.